Welcome to All Things Marine, Hawaii's thought-provoking show dedicated to marine science and ocean conservation. All Things Marine, brought to you by Kosi Island Earth and the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And now, here's your host, the marine science gal, Carly Weiner.
Aloha, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, and today we are going to talk about Shark Week, Hawaii style. With us today, some of Hawaii's up-and-coming shark researchers here to answer everything you wanted to know about sharks. I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Melanie Hutchinson, GIMAR Assistant Marine Researcher with the International Fisheries Program at NOAA's Pacific Island Fisheries Science Center, and Mark Royer, a graduate student at the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. First, we will talk with Melanie, one of the coolest women I know. Welcome to All Things Marine.
Thanks, Carly.
I'm so excited to have you on the show. I can't believe it's taken 3 years to get you here.
I am so excited to be here. Finally made it.
So I have so many questions for you.
Okay.
Hopefully we'll be able to squeeze it all into this short hour. So first, what got you interested in sharks? Tell me your story.
Okay. It's kind of funny because after I graduated from college, my first real science job was as a fisheries observer, and I couldn't get into grad school, so I took this job and I moved to Hawaii from San Francisco and went out to sea on longline fishing boats. But my interests were actually, I was trying to get into different coral labs because I was really interested in parasite-host relationships on coral reefs, but I had some problems getting accepted. And then
look who's laughing now on that one, though, right?
And then I was out at sea on the longline boats, and they're targeting tuna and swordfish. And there were really high rates of shark interactions, and that was kind of alarming. And so I started doing some research about kind of like I didn't think that the way that we were recording the data was actually really a good picture of what was occurring in the fishery. And so I started noticing that bycatch rates sometimes actually were higher than the targeted catch rates, but there weren't any management measures to deal with sharks like there were for like seabirds or sea turtles or marine mammals and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was looking for a research lab that I could get into to do some sort of shark bycatch mitigation stuff. And I found Kim Holland at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology.
Of course.
Which was perfect because I was here. And so he was willing to talk to me, told me to come to a lab meeting. And then I was in the lab. And then very fortuitously, this man named John Wong, who is also at the Science Center, he had a project that was funded by the Bycatch Reduction Engineering Program of NOAA, and it was to look at these electropositive metals and whether or not they actually reduced shark catch rates or like changed shark behavior. And so that ended up being my master's project. And then that experience kind of led to my PhD project and then also probably helped me get a job at the Science Center.
And here we are now.
And here we are.
Well, I'm super happy that you took the path that you did because the research that you are doing is so interesting and I can't wait to talk a little bit more.
Yeah, thanks.
So starting off with those fisheries observing vessels, that must have been an interesting experience for you too, not just seeing, you know, the shark bycatch, but what's that like being a female on those fishing boats?
It's pretty much like, I mean, it's really, really gnarly. It's the worst job, I think, that anybody could possibly have.
I could see that being a very difficult job. I appreciate your candidness with that.
I mean, but it was such a cool experience, you know, and it opened up so many opportunities for me. And just like being on the water like that is really, really incredible. I mean, some days the Pacific Ocean is like a lake, but I mean, we fished in a hurricane one time. And that was actually the thing, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. That was when I quit.
Well, I can imagine that would be a good reason to quit.
Yeah, the fishermen don't really like having females on the boat, and so that makes it a little bit more awkward. And then I was on a lot of boats that didn't have restroom facilities. Mm-hmm. So you're using a bucket on the back deck with all the fishermen, and not a lot of privacy.
You're a braver girl than I am.
Yeah, and the food is atrocious. Or sometimes you run out of food. One of the boats I was on ran out of food and water. And you do, like, your my behaviors were so bizarre. I was hoarding toilet paper, like, all kinds of really funny stuff. So some of the tuna fish that had shark damage, they would throw back overboard, and I would, like, go and hide the fish so that I could fillet it and have fish for dinner.
It's fresh fish. I mean, why not?
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm assuming now life's gotten a little bit better. The conditions are better when you go in and do research.
Yeah, and not all of the vessels were like that. I, for some reason, was always on boats that were just a little bit grosser than some of the other ones. I was on boats that had bed bugs. But, I mean, there's some boats that are absolutely beautiful.
Well, and hopefully now you're on the more beautiful
boats. I do get to go on the beautiful boats, yeah.
And now, when you go out, you're not just looking at one type of shark. I imagine there are many different types of sharks. Tell us a little bit about what you're studying.
So I work on shark bycatch issues, and these are issues in the high seas fisheries. So we typically interact with pelagic species, so that means open ocean, highly migratory species. And so most of my projects have been, well, my PhD was focused on silky sharks because they're the main bycatch species in the tropical tuna purse seine fisheries. And right now I have a couple projects working on the main bycatch species in longline fisheries, and those are blue sharks, mako. Sometimes mako sharks are retained, so they're actually they're a marketable catch. Oceanic white tips and silky sharks.
Very cool. So. Yeah. I've only seen the oceanics only because I've followed the pilot whales with some of my research.
So I know
they're around the pilots a lot. But for those of our listeners that haven't seen these sharks, can you kind of paint a picture between the difference, like silky shark versus mako?
Mako sharks kind of are the cousins of great white sharks, and they're actually just really gorgeous animals. They're blue on their dorsal surface, gray on the flanks, and then white bellies. And pointy nose, big eyes, they're really beautiful. They're some of the faster, more interesting of the shark species. Blue sharks are all blue. Silky sharks look a lot like gray reef sharks. They're kind of, you have to kind of be familiar with some of the different identifying characteristics, I guess, like their dorsal fins or something like that. And oceanic white tips have giant fins and dorsal fins, pectoral fins and dorsal fins, and they're rounded at the tips, and they're white on the tips. So they're like brown with these big white tips.
Very cool. So you're getting to experience all these different types of sharks in relation to the commercial fishing industry.
Yeah.
Now, does this take you just in Hawaii? Or are you looking at the industry all over the Pacific? Or where are you at?
A lot of the stuff I do is based here in Honolulu. But we're also working with the Observer Program in American Samoa. My PhD was on a purse seine vessel that is an American flag vessel that was out of American Samoa. So I get to go to Pongo Pongo a little bit. And and then conferences take you kind of far and wide. So I've gotten to do a fair bit of traveling for conferences and scientific committee meetings and stuff like that.
I love to hear that. What about the fisheries are the biggest threat to the sharks? I know bycatch, but can we talk a little bit more about that?
Sure, yeah. So shark bycatch is the unwanted, incidental, or accidental take of shark species in fisheries that are targeting other species. And typically, they're targeting tuna and billfish. There's a couple different major commercial industries and modalities of catching those species, and they're the purse seine fishery or longline fisheries. Purse seine fisheries wrap a net around whole schools, and then they're the ones that deliver most of the fish to the cannery. That fishery has high silky shark bycatch rates, and then the longline fishery where they set several miles of line and then hooks dangle down. And there's actually quite a bit more effort in that fishery. And so the impact that fishery has on pelagic shark populations is quite a bit greater just due to fishing effort alone. They also take several different shark species. But they're all discarded at sea. And so that's actually part of the issue. Now that finning is illegal, it's just the discards that are a big problem.
And now that finning has become illegal, has that fishery decreased, or is there still pockets where there are people fishing for sharks?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's still tons and tons that are entering the fin trade daily. So it's illegal. It's actually has a name. It's called illegal and unregulated and undocumented fishing. So IUU, fishing vessels.
Okay.
And they fish in marine protected areas. They essentially fish wherever they want and pretty much do whatever they want.
They're the bad guys.
They're the bad guys. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And are there mechanisms or ways that people report the bad guys of the fishing industry? Are there fish cops out there trying to reduce what they're doing?
Yeah, that's actually probably the most difficult thing of just about the nature of fishing on the high seas. You know, it's hard to observe. And right. So, yeah, there's something called black boxes on some vessels, but it's only nations that enforce the black box, and the black box tells whatever regulatory agency is watching these vessels where they are. So that is a means of enforcement. Observer programs are a means of enforcement, but essentially, there's not enough enforcement, and there's not anyone watching, really, you know?
Interesting.
So when they get caught, though, it's a big deal. They lose their vessel. There's major, major fines. But I don't think they get caught very often.
It's too bad to hear.
Yeah.
So what's now the biggest difference between when you were doing your PhD research and now as a professional shark researcher? Are you still working in the same, working on the same issues, or has that shifted at all?
My focus has always kind of been on shark bycatch. When I was in grad school, I got to participate in a lot of the labs projects, which were awesome and really, really fun. And that's pretty much where I got all of my field skills and experiences. And so Kim Holland's lab is a telemetry lab. And so we did a lot of shark movement modeling. So a lot of tagging and tracking all the pelagic predators around Hawaii. So that was a lot of fun. I don't have quite as much field work, or it's just a little bit more difficult to do it now in my current position. But I think the impact of the projects that I'm working on are a little bit greater.
They have more management applications.
Yeah, exactly. Imagine. Yeah.
And so I want to talk a little bit more about some of the equipment and methods you use for your research.
Okay.
I know we'll be, later on when we talk with Mark, we'll be getting into a little bit more depth with him on some of what he does in the field. But is your work similar? Are there different methods that you use for your research? Tell me about what would be a typical way you would do your shark work.
So right now I'm looking at trying to quantify post-release mortality rates and survival rates. And so we are having observers put satellite tags on sharks that are discarded from the longline fishery. And these satellite tags, it's kind of a newer technology. They're called survival pop-off archival tags. So they took a pop-off archival tag, which is a satellite tag, and they have a couple different sensors, and they archive all of the information until the predetermined pop-off date. And so they stay on the animal, and they archive temperature, depth, light, so that you can use different geolocation models to map some of their horizontal movements.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a little guillotine device on the tags. So at your predetermined time, the little computer on the tag sends a signal.
Snaps it off,
and then it floats to the surface and starts dumping all of its data to the Argos satellite array. And then you get an email with all of your information.
Don't you love that?
I love it.
In your inbox, here's all your
so
information.
Much.
There you go.
At 2 o'clock every day, I get an email from Argos.
That's wonderful. Is that your ritual at 2 o'clock? You have your afternoon coffee.
I have my afternoon coffee break, and then it's like, oh, who's talking? And actually, some of Mark's tagged hammerheads are talking to us right now.
All right. Yeah. I love that. And how do you figure some of the best practices for fishing around sharks? Does your research help to inform that at all?
Yeah, exactly. So that was one of the big questions for this project that we're starting. So we're having observers record information about the condition of the animal when they're brought to the vessel, how the fishers handled the animal, how they got them off of their equipment, how much fishing gear was still attached to the animal. Did they bring it up on deck and cut the hook out, or did they just like cut the line and let them go? And then what the condition is at release. And then we're also quantifying post-release mortality rates. And so we can identify which handling practices are the best handling practices, and then that has direct management applications, and we can make recommendations to the fishers. Here you go, this is the best way to maximize survival rates for discarded sharks. And the reason that you want to do that, I think that people sometimes aren't aware of the fact that pelagic shark populations are in grave states of decline. And so now it's starting to be a bit of a concern, because several of the species that interact with pelagic fisheries are currently assessed as being overfished, and they've found that overfishing is still occurring for some species. So
when you say the pelagic sharks that are in decline, for those of us that can't visualize that, are we talking great whites, tiger sharks? What species are specifically in decline?
The data isn't very good for mako sharks. Blue sharks are okay. Essentially, you use all of the biological information and all of the observer data and look at time series information to see what the populations are doing. Mm-hmm. And so we're actually looking at giant population numbers and looking to see like what it looks like. And it looks like it looks like a giant hill. It's a line that looks like a sloping hill. So it's all going down. And the species that are in the biggest trouble are oceanic white tips and silky sharks.
Okay. So with this information that we have now, obviously it's alarming, and there's been more awareness, I think, with the general public.
Absolutely.
We can see. What kind of regulations or management are changing within the United States government to help better protect these species?
Because these are highly migratory species, they have to be co-managed by all of the nations that are fishing in high seas waters.
That's where the problem lies.
And that's where the problem lies. Yeah. And so there's something called regional fishery management organizations. There's five. There's two in the Pacific Ocean, one in the Indian Ocean, one in the Atlantic, and then there's one for the conservation of southern bluefin tuna. And so in the Pacific, we're in the region for the Western Central Pacific Fisheries Commission, and so they hand down conservation and management measures. And these are, there's four. One is for sharks in general, and then there's one that are specific for oceanic white tips and silky sharks. And essentially, they're delegating nations to record more accurate information and handle animals in ways that will maximize post-release survival rates. So what we're doing now is actually in response to some management measures that have been handed down by some of the greater entities. And then the nations have to comply with these things.
It's going to be very rewarding, though, to see some of the research that you do and how that plays into management and helping protect the sharks.
It is. It's really interesting. And I think that I got really interested in management when I was presenting some of my PhD research to the scientific committee for the WCPFC, the giant regional fishery management organization. And so that was a very intimidating audience. But then you see exactly how the scientific information gets integrated into actual management measures, and a lot of it gets lost or distilled into tiny little tidbits that don't hold as much water as you feel like they should. But it is really interesting to see how the interplay occurs.
Yeah, you got to give your hats off to a lot of the scientists at HIMB working there for many years. A lot of their science is applicable to management and really making a difference in how people do marine conservation. Well, that's amazing. Melanie, I have so many more questions for you. We're going to take a quick commercial break because I want to bring Mark into the conversation. So hang tight. We'll take a quick break and we'll continue learning more about sharks.
My grades were bad. I would like get D's and C's.
I appeared to be doing good at my school life, but if you would see me at home, it would have been a completely different story.
I mean, it was just rough focusing on school when your mother is somebody you have to take care of.
It got worse and worse and worse throughout the years.
There are students who need somebody.
They can trust someone, and it could be the first person they've ever trusted in their life.
Communities and Schools is lowering America's dropout rate by helping more than 1.3 million kids every year get whatever they need to succeed in school.
If something was going on at home, we would go just stop by Miss Liberty's office and talk to her.
Communities and Schools vouched for me when everyone else had lost hope.
You can help change the picture of education right here in your community and across the nation. Visit communitiesandschools.org.
I hear people say we can't save every kid, but I think that we can.
Aloha. Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, and today we're doing Shark Week Hawaii style. Thought it was an appropriate time to discuss sharks, being as it was Discovery Shark Week a couple weeks ago, and we've got some amazing researchers here. Melanie, we're going to come back to you in just a few minutes here, but we have graduate student Mark Royer from the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology here with us today, and I'm curious to pick your brain. Mark, welcome to the show.
Aloha. Thanks for having me.
So, to start off, I want to hear all about what you do, but first and foremost, I was told you had a very exciting morning.
Indeed, we did. This morning actually ties into the research that I'm hoping to do for my master's and PhD work out here at the Hawaiian Institute of Marine Biology under UH. And so today, we have another lab mate who can't be with us. He's out at the American Lesbian Society meeting in Reno, but his name is Danny Coffey. He's looking at the dissolved oxygen levels that deep sea sharks swim through, or the dissolved oxygen in their environment when they're deep in the ocean. And my research is focused on the body temperature of sharks as they move through different depths in the ocean through different temperature regimes. So our first focus animal is going to be the six-gilled shark. It's a shark that has a cosmopolitan distribution, meaning that it occurs all around the world, mostly in deep waters and some areas where it's colder, such as off of the state of Washington. They come into shallower water, such as 50 feet. Around here in Hawaii, they're found in depths no shallower than 600, typically found between 900 at night and up to 2,000 feet during the day.
So we're not seeing these guys when we're snorkeling.
No, you'll never see these guys. You'll never see these guys scuba diving around Hawaii or snorkeling around here.
As a deep water shark, do they look slightly different, or what do they look like?
They do. All the deep water sharks have they all look very different, and they're typically very distinguishable from the more shallow water species we're used to seeing around here. Especially the six-gilled sharks, they're in the hexanchic form family.
Well, let's say that three times.
Yeah. But that's one of the most primitive families of sharks. Their fossils look very similar as they did almost 400 million years ago as they do today. So they look like, literally do look like something out of the dinosaur era or pre-dinosaur era, if you want to be exact. But what Danny and I did, we assembled a tag package that does multiple things at once. We put Danny's tag on there that measures dissolved oxygen, and I have a temperature tag on there that measures the water temperature and also the body temperature of the animal deep near its core. And so today we successfully deployed our tag package on a six-gilled shark. It will swim around with that package for about 5 days, and there's a release timer on it. And after 5 days, it will break the tie that connects the tag to the shark, and then it's made out of syntactic foam, so it'll then float to the surface. We have a satellite tag on there that will give off a little radio and satellite signal, so that way we can hone in on it and retrieve it, whether it pops off right off Kaneohe or halfway between here and Molokai. Wherever it pops off, we have to go retrieve it to get the data back from it.
So you don't get the email that Melanie gets with all your information in a nice little package.
We get as soon as the tag pops up to the surface, we'll get a similar email that tells us the location And then we hit out there on a boat, and we have a VHF transponder, and basically we just scan the horizon with it and basically just close in on the signal, which can either take a few hours or maybe a whole day.
Yeah, depending on ocean conditions, huh?
Yeah, it requires a lot of logistical planning for this because, for one, we have to not only assemble the tag and get the fishing gear ready, but you have to have good, safe weather conditions to set a fishing line in the evening, which is what we did last night. And then we went back at 6 a.m. this morning to haul it back in. And so because you're working with large animals, they have big teeth, rough skin, and expensive tag packages, and you have people's hands in the water at all times, you have to be very considerate of the safety aspect. So we are always constantly looking at the weather and basing our field operations around the weather for the sake of safety. But not only that, because our tag is going to pop off several days later, we have to look that farther ahead in the weather forecast and see, okay, are we going to have low winds? Because you don't want to go retrieve a tag floating out that's halfway between here and Molokai and 25 mile per hour in winds, because that's just, let me know, it's a little dangerous.
Yeah, definitely. Probably a very frustrating trip too, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
So you had a successful tagging this morning then. And so is that often for you to be able to tag a shark? Like, what's your success rate? Do you get to tag every time you go out, or is it sort of hit or miss?
It all varies based on what species it is you're going for. Mm-hmm. For these six-gill sharks, we have about a 50% success rate of trying to catch them, where every time we do go out and set our lines in 900 feet of water, half the time we do catch a six-gill shark. We have to make sure it's in good health and in good condition to make sure that some other animal didn't come by and try to bite it while it was on the line. And so, but I don't want to jump the gun and say we are mission success so far, because we still have to make sure that the tag is actually getting data that we want and make sure it retrieves and all the components are still attached to it and that we can get it back and download it properly.
Of course. I will remain optimistic for you, of course. Thank you. And so, I mean, so exciting, the work that you do. And I asked Melanie this right off the bat, so I'm curious to know the differences. Is what drew you to sharks? How did you start working with sharks in the first place?
Well, my interest in sharks probably began before I could even remember, when I was about 3 years old. I grew up over in Smyrna Park, Maryland, and my grandmother would take me to the Baltimore Aquarium on a very regular basis. And out there, the shark tanks they had there and these big shark silhouettes were fascinated me ever since I was a little kid, and they still fascinate me today. My parents also took me out into the Chesapeake Bay and to the ocean in Ocean City a lot, and I learned my ABCs through the names of fish in the Atlantic, so I had a very early introduction to marine biology as a kid, and sharks always kept my interest. And even when I was little, before it was more common knowledge now, I knew that sharks were being their populations were in decline. They were being finned for shark fin soup. And back then, sharks were still regarded. People had saw that the Jaws mentality, that, you know, sharks were something to be afraid of, and they didn't really think very highly of them. So as I was going on into college, I wanted to get into marine biology and study sharks, for one, because they not only did they fascinate me, but I wanted to do something that could contribute to their knowledge of them and also, to that effect, help their benefit their conservation as well. During college, in my sophomore year, I was looking for internships, and luckily I had a brother living in San Diego at the time, and so I was looking at internships there. And of course, you know, the prestigious Scripps Institution of Oceanography is out there, and there was a professor out there named Dr. Jeff Graham, who used to study physiology of sharks and other fish as well. I sent an email to him and sent him my resume, and there was a student named Andy Nosal who needed help tagging and tracking leopard sharks along the California coast. So I joined up with him and got my first taste of field experience of what it's like to catch a shark, put a tag on it, track them, and try to find them in the water. It was a very rewarding experience, and they also led me to do my own research, where I got to study the foraging ecology or the diets of leopard sharks within the Southern California area. And then upon graduating from my undergrad, I then came out here and joined Kim Holland's lab with Melanie and everyone else to help do the tagging studies out here.
Very cool. So you've been doing some shark stuff all over the place now, from California to Hawaii. Are there plans to do any other shark research outside of Hawaii?
For the time being, I would like to do that. Certainly, I like to spend my free time looking through shark identification books because I love seeing the illustrations and seeing where different sharks live. I'm always fascinated to hear other shark research coming from different areas, whether it's Australia or in the Pacific Northwest or other areas of that are just largely unexplored, such as areas like the Red Sea or even sharks in like the Middle East even.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite shark species?
I do. That would be the thresher sharks, which is actually a family. There's three different species, but I find them extremely fascinating. In terms of my research, I like to focus on thermophysiology of how sharks regulate their body temperatures as they move through different water temperatures, or water or temperature regimes, I mean. There's one species of thresher shark that has the internal red muscles similar to what a mako and a great white have that allows them to maintain an elevated body temperature. The other two sharks, thresher shark species, don't have that specialized red muscle, but they still can move through cold water and warm water. And it would be interesting to know what their activity is like when they're moving through these different temperature regimes, whether they're foraging in both cold deep water and warm shallow water. And that's also important to know because they too are also, their populations are declining and are taken as incidental bycatch or targeted for their fins as well. And in some areas they're caught, they're targeted for the sake of their meat, they're sold, especially in the Southern California and Baja, Mexico, California region. So I'd like to learn more about that species and
I'm interested,
contribute to their conservation.
I'm interested in this idea that you're looking at in terms of the thermal regulation or thermal physiology of these different sharks. Does it vary greatly between different species in different regions and, I guess, different depths as well?
It really does. In terms of between different depths, that's something I'm actually trying to figure out where we've... There's been a lot of research on the lamnid sharks, that is the mako and great white, because they have kind of like yellowfin tuna or bluefin tuna. They have, like I said, like the internal red muscles. They have blood vessels that run countercurrent to each other so that their body activity, the red muscles is what they use for sustained swimming. And if you ever look at the body of a great white or a tuna, they're very torpedo-shaped, very streamlined.
Yeah.
They're very active swimmers. And so by having these blood vessels run through the red muscle, it allows the body heat to be retained. It's the same way with mako sharks and great whites. However, other sharks, they don't have that kind of specialization, but they still move through different temperature regimes. So animals such as the blue shark was studied way back, and that's where some of the earliest telemetry studies show that they move from warm, shallow water to deep cold water, and they track their body temperature when they do that. And there are some shark species around here in Hawaii. One example is the scalloped hammerhead, which from our tagging data has shown that they do move from shallow water down into deep cold water, which really surprised us because they don't have, as far as we can tell, we can't see any physiological adaptations that allow them to do that. So it's interesting to see if there's other mechanisms that they use to try to go from a shallow habitat to a very deep habitat. And in terms of these deep sea sharks, like the six gills, even though they're in cold water, they still migrate every day from deep water into slightly shallow water. It's still deep in comparison to us, but the difference between, let's say, 1,500 feet of water and 700 feet of water can be a difference of 5 degrees Celsius and 15 degrees Celsius, so it might be interesting to see if that slight change in water temperature can affect their physiology or their swimming activity.
Very cool. And you mentioned the hammerhead sharks. I know we have a lot of those here in Hawaii. So you see, I've seen many times fishermen pull them up when they're fishing, you know, the baby ones in the springtime off the shore. Do you study those as well or look at the hammerhead populations?
Yes, actually. The hammerhead is one of the species I would love to study out here in terms of we hope that Danny and I can get our specialized tag package on them to see what their body temperature is like, what water temperatures they're swimming through, what the oxygen is like when they're swimming through the water. And we've seen from some preliminary tag data that initially you would think that a hammerhead stays in warm, shallow water, but we've seen that they actually do go quite deep and exploit much deeper habitats.
We have a couple that are diving to 1,200 meters regularly.
Wow, yeah. That's quite deep.
Yeah.
Wow. And are they traversing long distances as well, like some of the other sharks in Hawaii?
We hope to figure that out with some of satellite tagging that data that we've acquired over the years. And plus, just recently this past week, we've put some more tags on them as well. We're currently in the process of analyzing a lot of tag data, but Melanie has been doing a lot of tagging of hammerheads here in Hawaii for the past several years as well.
They're actually listed by the United States as endangered species. There's six distinct population segments. Four of them are endangered species, so they have different protection measures. The Hawaii population segment is doing well, so it's not protected. And genetic data shows that it's a bit distinct from some of the other coastal regions where hammerheads show up. And some of our early tracking data shows that we do, in fact, have a Hawaiian scalloped hammerhead population. So they're ranging far and wide, and they're traversing the entire Hawaiian archipelago and then going out into the open ocean. But they appear to come back regularly and stick to this region.
Wow, that's amazing. And is the genetic data showing that the hammerhead sharks are specific to just Hawaii as a region in general, or are there genetic breaks between like the main and northwestern Hawaiian islands for those species?
Yes. I don't think that there are genetic breaks within the North Pacific, tropical Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
So the contiguous coastal North and South America, that's a distinct segment, and there's a genetic break between that population and the one that is found in Hawaii.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And I see, Mark, you're wearing the Papahana Mokuakea shirt. Have you been able to do any shark research up in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands?
I have, yes. Dr. Carl Meyer in our lab has been maintaining research on reef predators up the northwestern Hawaiian Islands for, I think, close to 15 years now at this point. And I've been fortunate enough to go, I was able to go with him back in 2012 on a cruise on the Hi'ialakai up there to help do some tagging and tracking of not just sharks, but also alua, umilu, and other large predatory fish. And since then, I've been able to go up there on the Hi'ialakai every year and have helped do some more tagging of sharks and other large fish in that area. But those fish, we've done a lot of acoustic tagging. That's where we implant a little acoustic transmitter inside the visceral cavity of the shark or the fish. That way they'll retain the tag for many, many years. And we have these listening stations staged around the different reefs at certain northwestern Hawaiian islands, such as Midway, Pearl and Hermes Atoll, and French Frigate Shoals as well. So for the past 2 years, past 3 years, we've tagged mostly Galapagos sharks and alua and have been tracking their movements. But in the past, there's a huge data set from everything from tiger sharks, gray reef sharks, and uku and many other species as well.
So funny. Everybody always says they're scared of sharks in the water. I think alua are the ones to be scared of. I'm much more scared of alua than sharks.
We've seen it up there where when we throw bait in the water, when a shark approaches it, the luas are usually the first ones to get it, and they'll sometimes...
And they chase off the sharks.
They'll chase off the sharks.
Yeah, that's hilarious. So when you're implementing or inserting these tags, someone once told me that sharks can regulate their bleeding. They can stop themselves from bleeding. Is that true? Is that when it's easy to implant a tag in a shark?
Typically, we try to choose a spot that we think will have minimal bleeding when we implant the tag. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when we cut right into the muscle layer, there's little to no bleeding in some cases. It just kind of depends on how good you are and if you get lucky and make sure you don't hit a vein or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm actually not too familiar with that. But I imagine it's like most other body systems where if you bleed out of a certain area, it will try to clot
pretty quickly
or shut down blood flow to that area quickly. But when we do the incisions, we make them just wide enough to fit something that's about the size of a AA battery or just slightly larger in lengthwise, and then we can just stitch it right back up. Yeah. But from all the recaptures we've had of our sharks, because every time we catch a shark, we always put an ID tag on it by its dorsal fin. So if we ever recapture a shark that's been tagged before, we can look at the ID number and see when it was previously tagged. And we've seen that these sharks and fish have a pretty fast healing rate, where usually if it's been several months, you either There's barely no even see the scar.
Well, I was lucky enough in 2006, quite some time ago, to go out with Carl and watch him do some shark tagging. And, you know, it amazes me how much care and precision is taken into account when doing this. And the amount of information that you are able to retrieve from this is absolutely amazing. Mm-hmm. I want to hear so much more. We're going to take a quick break here. And when we come back, both of us will chat more about sharks.
Peter Herrick was a 34-year-old carpenter when he joined the Navy Reserve. Peter's wife, Diana.
They were deployed to build schools and bases and to assist the Marines.
When the mortar round hit, I was completely knocked out. I didn't wake up until 6 days later.
Paralyzed veteran, Senior National Service Officer Raymond Bruce.
I saw Pete when he was at his worst. He didn't know if he was going to live to be able to see his daughter graduate from high school.
Raymond knew that I needed help figuring out where do we go from here.
We not only represent the veteran, but we represent the whole family.
11 months we stayed in the hospital down in Tampa.
We advocate, we educate, and we process claims through the VA, and we follow that claim from the beginning to the end.
Without Paralyzed Veterans of America, I really honestly believe I'd still be in the hospital.
You can help our paralyzed veterans. To learn more, visit pva.org. A public service of Paralyzed Veterans of America.
Welcome back. I'm Carly Weiner, your Marine Science Gal. And if you're just joining us, we are talking sharks this week, Hawaii style. With me today is Melanie Hutchinson and Mark Royer, two amazing shark researchers that I'm super happy to have on the show. So we've talked a lot about some of the research that you do, how you got into the sharks. I want to talk about sharks in the broader scale now. I chose this topic for our monthly segment partially because of Discovery Shark Week. Everybody's Perfect. Been talking about sharks lately. Tell me, I'm curious about your opinion. You know, there's been a lot in the media with Discovery in the past not having the most accurate or over-dramatizing shark attacks for Shark Week, but they seem to have gotten a lot more press this year about having some better coverage of some of the shark research and conservation issues. What are your opinions on that?
Yeah, certainly I've had a negative opinion about previous years, especially with the whole megalodon to do where they made these fake documentaries saying that megalodon still exists.
So it doesn't. It still exists. Just to clarify.
Just to clarify the megalodon is extinct.
And I don't think that there are actually mermaids.
Okay.
And there are no mermaids either.
But, crushing the souls of seven-year-olds everywhere.
I know, it's tragic.
But luckily this year, because Discovery Communications got a new president, he said in a press conference that he really wanted to make Shark Week more about science and actually about sharks and not make it all about blood and gore or about, you know, giant creatures that
I
are
think
extinct.
They tried, but they still kind of missed the mark. They were calling a couple of shark bite victims shark experts on a couple of the programs, and I mean, it's still about the wow factor, you know, because people need to be engaged, I guess.
I don't know. I think sharks are pretty wow on their own.
I think so too. I mean, we do such cool work, you know, and so that's pretty. We actually get approached a lot to work with Discovery and do some Shark Week programs, but we typically decline the offers because of the fact that they kind of change the storyline a little bit to like when sharks attack, you know, and it's just not what we do.
Yeah, so that's still there, but yeah, there were two episodes this season in particular that stood out. Where one was called Alien Sharks 3, which
in
the previous 2 years, it's always a focus about deep or largely unknown sharks, and on these programs, it's all about, you know, discovering and trying to learn more about these deep sea sharks that the general public doesn't really know that much about, or many people don't know much for that matter. So I remember a couple of years, like the first time they showed it, they actually got footage of a mega mouth shark, which, you know, those things have been seen like just about around like around 50 or 60 times, mm-hmm. living or dead for that matter. And this year, I think they showed footage of someone putting a satellite tag on one, so that's extremely exciting to hear about. They also featured a lot of women scientists as well in that episode, which they've received criticism in the past about that, because, you know, I think this room shows a demographic for that, where, you know, a lot of early career scientists nowadays are, it's a very even split between men and women now.
Go gender equality?
Yeah.
Now, I mean, it's great to hear that things are improving with that perception in Shark Week and that there's a lot of interest, but there still is a lot of fear out there. And how do you address the public when they come to you and ask you about sharks and, you know, are kind of still scared of sharks and should they be?
Well, I tell them that they're much more likely to die by getting hit by a coconut. Or yep. to get hit by a car while going to the beach or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's so, I mean, the odds are so low, you know? I mean, it's like being afraid of lightning and Coke machines and coconuts. You just can't live life like that, you know?
Precisely. You have to be very objective with them in that, yes, when a shark attack does happen, it's a very tragic incident where someone gets hurt or worse, and it's, you know, kind of scary too, because there's a lot of, it's a big animal with teeth and someone got horribly mangled, but at the same time it's like, you know, that gets into people's minds. But as Melanie said, you know, if you think about how many people just in Hawaii alone are in the water every single day, your chances of getting attacked are very, very low. Granted, you should generally, we always tell people you should follow general ocean safety conditions, which is, you know, don't always go alone. You know, you increase your risk of something bad happening if you go further offshore by yourself. And also other safety factors, like especially like to tell surfers, you know, don't surf near a harbor entrance or a river mouth if it's been after a large rain event. We have a lot of outflow coming out of a river and you have low visibility.
Complex chemical cues, weird smells in the water.
Exactly. Yeah. So follow general safety, ocean safety rules.
Common sense is not always right there for everybody. But, you know, it's hard because you don't hear on the news, well, today there was no shark attacks for 364 days of the year. Yeah. But, you know, you do hear when there are shark attacks. And, for example, this past summer there's been quite a few publicized off North Carolina.
Yeah.
And so that, I feel like, plays a lot into people's fears. What do you think that's been going on the East Coast?
I don't know. I haven't been paying very close attention, but it probably has something to do with changing oceanographic and climatic conditions. So different water masses bringing different forage fish maybe closer to the beaches or inshore in places where they typically aren't, and there's sharks actively feeding in the area, you know? And so I know that a lot of the shark interactions or shark attacks in Florida, the person that got bit pretty much knew they shouldn't be in the water because they saw bait balls right next to their surfing waves.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, it could have something to do with that. Or maybe there are some rogue sharks out there that are just going after kids.
Or that. And I know there was a lot of attention with some of the shark attacks off Maui, mm-hmm. That have happened in the last couple of years. Have you been working on any of the research looking at that?
Yeah, that's our lab. We're the state contracted us to put some satellite tags on sharks around Maui and compare that to some of our tracking information for tiger sharks that we've captured around the Big Island and Oahu.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're using different satellite tag technologies and acoustic in combination with some acoustic data to try to elucidate some of the inshore behaviors and habitat use. And it's been really interesting. We're just now starting to do some of the real data analysis because we've been working on the project for a couple of years. And so we've gotten quite a bit of data. Identified a few hotspots for surface activity in tiger sharks around Oahu and Maui. One of those corresponds with where some of the shark interactions have been.
Mm-hmm.
But pretty much, I just totally lost my train of thought, but a lot of the movement information is actually published on the web, and it's really actually very interesting to see the tracks, so where the animals have been. So we've kind of negated the whole resident shark, you know, at one beach, where they are visiting the same sites relatively mm-hmm. often, but between site visits, they've probably gone and visited a couple other islands, circumnavigated Maui a few times.
Sure.
Some that have gone 1,000 miles south and come back, some that have gone 1,000 miles north and come back. Mm-hmm. So
is there something about these spots where you're seeing more sharks? Is there, you know, preferential food for them there,
we haven't been collecting any oceanographic data, but essentially we know that tiger sharks like the inshore shelf, so they like habitats that are shallower than 200 meters, and Maui has a larger shelf than some of the other islands, and so or the Maui complex, I guess. Tiger sharks also really like penguin banks. They seem to show up at off Molokai, which is also a shallow habitat. So, and tiger sharks also have a really broad diet, so they're essentially foraging wherever the fishes are, I think.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Now, you see, in a place where there's a lot of surfing and there are sharks, you see in a lot of the surf shops these shark deterrents, different mm-hmm. kinds. You see the striped outfits and yeah. the pingers and all that. Do they really work? What's your opinion on these shark deterrents?
So what these deterrents are doing is they're exploiting the unique electrosensory capability of sharks. And so these things are pretty much electric devices that put off weird, novel sensory information that could either intrigue the animal or deter it. And so my master's, I was testing electropositive metals to see if they would reduce shark bycatch in longline fisheries. Mm-hmm. And when I was doing some of my behavioral experiments, so I had some smaller juvenile animals in tanks, and I would present them with baits that either had the electropositive metal near them or they didn't. And it was very individual in my animals. So some of them were very intrigued by it and really liked it, and they would bite on it, and some were totally repulsed by it and they wouldn't get anywhere near it. And so I don't think there's been a few papers that have tested different magnetic things, different electrical things, but I don't think there's any one silver bullet, because also different species are kind of, they have different sensitivities to electric voltages and stuff like that.
It's also important to remember that the electrosensory for a shark is a very near-field sense, where people have this idea that if you put this on your ankle, then all sharks within a mile are going to stay away from you. But the reality is that the shark wouldn't be able to sense the changes in the electric field unless it's only about
a meter
away from you. So by the time a shark gets within like range of sensing whatever this thing is on your ankle, it's going to be very, very close to you. It's definitely an area that requires more study. In areas where great whites are more the culprit in attacks, those things probably won't do too much, because they are very visual predators, usually looking for silhouettes on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
So if they were to come at you at the high speed that they do, if it detects your little ankle bracelet within a meter, it's probably not going to do much for you in that regard.
It's a little too late.
All right.
But talking with peripheral communication with people who have like tested it themselves, where they have like they throw like a lot of chum in the water and they have these sharks feeding, then they said they throw this ankle brace in the water and the sharks all kind of like, you know, back away from the food real quick.
Right.
The important thing about that is that usually when we're surfing, our ankles are dangling in the water, so that's different than having a sudden change. When you throw this ankle brace in the water, that's a sudden change in the electric field, whereas if you dangle your ankles in the water, that's a very constant field that's in the water, so it's going to be a different sensation for the shark than the way how it's being tested sometimes.
Sure. So the jury's still out then on that one.
Right.
Well, that answers a lot of questions. Melanie, Mark, thank you so much. You have been fantastic guests today, and I mean, I could talk here for another hour about sharks, so we'll have to have you come back on again. I want to give a big thank you to both Dr. Melanie Hutchinson and Mark Royer for sharing their knowledge with us. I'd also like to thank our sponsors, the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology and Kosi Island Earth. I'm Carly Weiner. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.